Hello and welcome to episode 10 of No Small Victories, produced by Haringey Wellcome, the last of season one. So far, we've celebrated those working to end the hostile environment and those who've had to navigate their way through it. In this episode, we commemorate someone who did both, a dear friend of Haringey Wellcome, Sherif Barko, also known as Majid Hassan. Sherif was a long-standing Haringey resident and a refugee from Darfur's Masalit community. In January 2021, he was tragically killed on a return visit to family in Darfur. As it's the 20th anniversary year of the onset of the Darfur genocide, we discuss the current crisis in Sudan and how it happened. We look at the hostile UK asylum system that's ensnared Sherif, as it has countless others. And we touch on the illegal migration bill currently going through Parliament that seeks to extend this hostility even further by effectively banning refugees altogether, including those from Sudan. Sherif's story is one of courage, resilience, and remarkably of hope, despite revealing brutal cruelty, tragedy, and systemic failure at both a global and national level. But at the heart of this episode is our celebration of Sherif as a dear friend who always lived his life with integrity, resilience, honour, bravery, and kindness. You'll hear several voices. Saif el-Din Nemir, UNICEF's Chief of Eastern Iraq Field Office and close friend of Sherif's. Sonia Miley, Co-Executive Director of Waging Peace, a charity focused solely on Sudan. Myself, Lucy Nabijou, and Tania Harmer, No Small Victories producer. And Sherif himself, from an audio recording made in 2016. Here's episode 10. Talking about a dear friend and colleague in Haringey Wellcome, Sherif Barko, who is also known as Majid Hassan. Sherif was from Sudan, Darfur, and very sadly, Sherif was killed in January 2021. He was a wonderful advocate for migrant justice and also for his people, the Masalit people of Darfur. Today, we really want to explore Sherif, his life and legacy, and also the current crisis in Sudan, what the situation is like, what its roots are, and how this traces back to 20 years ago when the genocide in Darfur was happening. So we're trying to cover a lot of different things, including Sherif's experience of seeking asylum in the UK and dealing with many barriers to integration, his wonderful personality and his gifts that he shared with so many people, and also talking more broadly about the situation in Sudan. So to help us to do this, we're delighted and honoured to be joined by two wonderful guests, Sonia Miley and Saif el-Din Nemir. I'm going to ask you both if you could introduce yourself. So firstly, Sonia Miley from Waging Peace.
I'm Sonia Miley, and I am alongside Maddie Crowther, co-executive directors of Waging Peace, a charity based in the UK that works solely on Sudan. We are focused on Sudan and have been since 2004, so coming up to 20 years. And we particularly work with asylum-seeking communities here in the UK.
Hello, everyone. My name is Saif el-Din. In short, it is Saif. Originally from Darfur, and I live here in the UK. I work for UNICEF. My current duty station is Iraq, and I am looking forward to speak about the current crisis in Sudan. And I am also a close friend to the late Sharif. And there are few memories that I can also share.
And here is Sharif's voice, recorded in 2016, telling his story for a Haringey welcome event.
I don't know how to start. I used to live in a village here. I used to do like some business, like I've got camels, just take some goods and go around villages.
I was at a friend's party, Nowruz party, with a lot of other people from many different countries. And Sharif was there with his cousin. And it was the first time I'd met him, but he was a very striking person, immediately noticeable. He had a very loud laugh and a very big smile, and he smiled often.
I knew Sharif since we were very young, maybe 6, 7 years young. We used to play football out on the streets together. We used to do a few things together in those days, until he moved out of that neighborhood, and then we were left there. I mean, the communication between us was kind of cut at that stage. Until when I went all the way to high school, I traveled to Khartoum, and there I realized that he's in Khartoum. And there again, our relationship started to grow up.
We were first introduced to Sharif through you and Haringey Welcome. You know, at first at the sad occasion of Sharif's online memorial. And working on Sudan, you know, we've met many, many people from various different parts of Sudan in the UK.
Sudan is a country based in the heart of Africa. Geographically, it is just located just south of Egypt, a home to many tribes. Those tribes in the past used to live in a very good harmony with no conflicts that could be escalated to a real issue until we have a government, the government that came into power using ideology and stayed in power using that ideology to kill people and to kill more and more. That government came with greediness. That government came with the idea that for them, this is going to be a holy war, a survival for them to continue, because they think that they are serving a holy purpose. In that perspective, the war started in Darfur back in 2003. Reasons for that war, unfortunately, many media channels are describing it as if it is a conflict between the farmers and the livestock owners, which is absolutely wrong. This conflict back in 2003, it is a political conflict. A conflict that was fueled and supported by the government sitting in Khartoum. The National Congress Party government that was sitting in Khartoum, they used a militia to fight on their behalf, some of those people in Darfur. Why the people in Darfur were targeted by the government? Because there was a movement by the Darfurians asking for justice, asking for equal opportunities, asking for equal share in the country revenues. So this government will not generate anything. So they pick up their arms and they started fighting the government. It was supposed to be a fight with the government. The government recruited a militia to fight on their behalf.
There are incredible, incredible resources in Sudan that are also being vied for by political structures and taken from the people. There is also the systemic structures based and rooted in the ideology that Saif spoke to that are very racist, that there are targeted policies that disadvantage those who are Black African as opposed to the Arab population. And that is a familiar dynamic that we have seen around the world, including in the UK. Not necessarily that sort of, you know, the Arab population and the Black African, but we see the systemic roots of structural racism that upholds policies that disadvantage certain groups. So it's important to point out that also exists within Sudan and continues to exist.
We used to have really good life, and we have got a lot of problems. A lot of people are killing and people dying for nothing. And this government killing innocent people without no reason at all. They put me in prison for a little while. Yeah.
We don't know the tribes as such. We were just the community of West Darfur, and many people did not even know the tribes of other members until this conflict. And then by the time people started talking about your loyalty and your tribe and which tribe is to be targeted and which tribe is the tribe that people want to fight with.
My uncle, he came just to the prison and told me that, yeah, he can organize something to release you, mm-hmm. and just you can get away from the country.
When I was going to university, I had to come through Khartoum several times. I met him until I was informed that he left. Again, the communication between us was kind of cut.
I got the ship from Sudan to Egypt, and then I paid the agent, and he said, I'll take you to Europe. I wasn't know where exactly, but I came here to England.
Sharif arrived actually in November 2002 and claimed asylum. And after a period of time, I don't know how long, his asylum claim had been refused. Poor Home Office decision-making contributed to the delay in Sharif receiving his refugee status, a problem that persists to this day, as Sonia explains.
The country policy and information notes on Sudan, which are called CPIN notes, they were published by the Home Office, currently on the Home Office website, and they were circulated with decision-makers from October 2021. It was 4 days before the 25th of October 21 military coup. So what that means is the CPIN itself is outdated. All of the information in that CPIN is pointing to how safe it is in Sudan, particularly in Khartoum, and especially for non-Arab Darfuris to be returned to Khartoum. These information notes, the CPIN notes, are what are pointed to when those adjudicating asylum look at for information on how to determine somebody's individual claim.
I'm looking for a job and no jobs. And also, they're asking for papers to work, and mm-hmm. it was really difficult. When they refused my case, then it was really difficult. No support at all. And also the accommodation, they said you have to leave it. I was here in London. I used to sleep in the telephone boxes, and I don't know where to go. No job, no nothing. It was really a terrible time.
Sharif didn't speak any English before he came, so he needed to learn English. But actually accessing ESOL classes was very difficult. And He really struggled to get any consistent language training. In fact, one of the things we used to do when we met was have an English lesson, and then he'd give me an Arabic lesson, and then we'd cook some food. And you know, but I mean, that's in a way beside the point. The formal support for integration was not there.
In the UK, no matter what degrees you hold back home, when you come as an asylum seeker, as a refugee, and when you got the status of being a refugee, you need to start from zero.
And he got so desperate that at one point, somebody he met suggested that he make a second asylum claim, but to use a different name.
They did like a fingerprint, and they found out I used to have another
application. Okay.
And they arrested me in prison for 9 months.
After which he would have been deported. And it was only because of the intervention of the charity Freedom from Torture. Some good people from there heard about his case, intervened, found him proper legal representation. He was able to make an appeal, and that's when he won his refugee status after all of that struggle for over 2 years. So I met him in March 2005. So on that particular day, he was in an extremely good mood because he had refugee status. Finally, all that stress was out of the way. He could get on with living his life, or so he thought.
After 2003, there were very few members of the Masjid community in the United Kingdom. And Sharif was one of those people. Hearing the news from back home, they could see that a big number of the Masjid community have already crossed the border to Chad and they became refugees. Another big number of them, and they were pushed to the displaced camps in the city. And then the rest were in the diaspora. They have just decided that we need to support our community, the whole Masjid. And that's why they came together. So they were thinking about collecting money and trying to send it out.
Sadly, it was not long after that first meeting that Sharif learned the absolutely tragic news that his wife and his two sons, young sons in Darfur, had been killed by the Janjaweed. Their village was attacked and their home was burnt and they died. And the tragedy, one part of this tragedy is that he had obviously wanted to bring his family to safety as soon as possible, but it was impossible for him to get family reunion until he had his refugee status, which came too late. It was an absolutely devastating blow for him, of course, and I know for a fact that he suffered for the rest of his life with survivor guilt.
The number of the Masjid community members who started arriving in the United Kingdom was increasing. So the number one responsibility for the charity in the UK was to receive those who arrived here, to help them go through the asylum route. And of course, you all know how difficult it is. Some people were a little bit frustrated because the expectations were that you come to the UK and the following day you will be granted asylum. So people were also morally supported, psychologically supported by the charity, which is still ongoing. So going back to Sharif's role, he was one of those who actually put the seed of this charity. And now the charity has grown big and we can reap the fruits of that one.
And in the case of Sharif, he was in his 40s. He wasn't a young man. He didn't have formal qualifications. He really struggled to find work and he struggled to get, to develop his education. I know that he aspired to go to university. He aspired to work in human rights. He had many ambitions, and he would have been an excellent person to do those things. But he just faced endless barriers. The work that he ended up doing was manual, hard labor, long hours, low pay, insecure, ununionized, exploitative. When could he have time to study or to build that side of himself? And as I came to understand, much of the time when he was working, he was also saving money, because he was saving to help other people, to help his Masalit community in Darfur.
I've got nothing from there. I've got nothing from back home. Absolutely nothing. Yeah, I want to go and visit. Because even I want to go and visit. I've got like my children and wife. Even they haven't got the grave to see them, you know, just because they kill them and burn them in the fire. Yes, yeah.
Sharif's aim was eventually to, as for most refugees, to become a British citizen, to get citizenship. But it took him a long time. It took over 10 years of his being in the UK before he was actually able to become a British citizen. Part of that, ironically, part of the delay was when he first applied, and the application fees, one has to say, are enormous. And this is one of the things that he had to save up for from his meagre earnings. I can't remember, but it was, you know, hundreds of pounds to make an application for citizenship. His first application for citizenship was denied on the basis that he had an unspent conviction, which referred to the 9 months that he'd been imprisoned. And the irony of that for me is huge. Just insult to injury. But in any case, after some time, he was able to make a fresh application for citizenship, and he was granted citizenship.
There is a lot going on in the Nuba Mountains. There is a lot going on in the Blue Nile. But how many of us know about it, I am not very much sure. The media headlines are only about Khartoum at this stage, but we need to shed the light about the situation in the other parts of the country as well. We need to make sure that the Foreign Office, as well as the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they have enough budgets to allocate aid for those left back home. That is an international role that the UK government is expected to play. But of course, given the situation in country, I'm not 100% optimistic that that budget is going to be increased.
Those other parts of Sudan who are also suffering, like Saif has said, in the Nuba Mountains, South Kordofan areas, Blue Nile State, and East Sudan, as well as Khartoum. Because actually, if you are really wanting to understand what is happening now, we need to look at the whole of the country. There are elements of the same faction that have, by design, brought conflict to the areas in outside of the center. It is all part of the same story, if you will.
Tanya, No Small Victories producer, asked me questions about Sharif's decision to return to Sudan.
Can I ask you just to maybe follow his immigration story in the UK? He decided to return to Darfur, to Sudan, to visit.
Sharif decided to change his name by deed poll to ensure greater safety for his return to Darfur. And, you know, people might wonder, well, why would you go back? Well, I think that it's very understandable why he needed to go back. He'd spent something like 14 years away from his home country. grappling with survivor's guilt, trauma. He desperately needed to go back. I remember him saying that he needed just to go to the place where his family had died, and he hoped to make a gravestone. So eventually he did go back. He managed to find his sister and some of his surviving relatives, and on that trip agreed to remarry. I think that was 2017. So he reconnected with Darfur, and I think that trip also reinforced his absolute determination to help people back home. So he'd already been involved in setting up a charity in the UK for the Masalit people.
And so from about 2017, when he returned, in the subsequent few years of his life, he travelled back and forth to Sudan, am I right?
After he married, what I think he really wanted to do was to bring his wife to the UK to live here as a family. But there are, again, many barriers to people doing that. The UK government have instituted levels of income that are required, for example, for the UK citizen before they are able to bring their spouse. Also, the spouse needs to have achieved a certain level of English language before they can be admitted to the country and so forth. So there were delays and problems with that. At that point, he was working as an Uber driver, as well as doing security work at night. He would switch between the two or do both. Just working like a dog, really long hours, and work, 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 save, save, save. And then he would go on an annual trip to Darfur to spend time with his family, with his wife, with his community there.
I'm going to move, unfortunately, to the part that I guess none of us would like to be talking about, but to ask you, when you learned about Sharif's death.
In 2020, he had gone to visit his family and his wife in Darfur. And of course, then that was the start of the COVID pandemic. So he ended up being unable to return to the UK. Sudan was in shutdown. And so he got stuck there for many months, which was very difficult because he had responsibilities. He needed to get back here to be earning money, but he was stuck. And during that time, his wife became pregnant, and the baby was due in November 2020. He managed to get out of Sudan and come back to London, I think, in August that year. So he'd been here for a couple of months, and then I remember him calling to say that, tragically, his wife had died in childbirth, and the baby had survived. He had a little daughter. So at that point, he needed to go back to Darfur to make arrangements for looking after his daughter. And he spoke quite clearly about what he wanted for her. She would spend some time there while she was a little toddler, and then when she was a little bit older, two or three, he wanted to bring her to London. Anyhow, so he went back in December 2020. On the 18th of January 2021, I received a phone call from a mutual friend, Hubert, who told me the unbelievable news that Sharif had been killed 2 days before. And obviously, it was, I mean, initially I couldn't take it in, and, you know, then it was just absolutely devastating. And what had happened, I subsequently learned, was during 2020, there had been a long-standing United Nations mission in Darfur since the genocide had started. And in 2020, that mission, UNAMID, had finally pulled out. And this was in the context of the transitional government and a lot of politics going on in the Sudanese nation. And people in Darfur had been very concerned about the UN pulling out, because they predicted that this would lead to an uptick in conflict. And that is precisely what happened. And in fact, my understanding is that the conflict that in which Sherif was killed, which was very soon after the UN pulling out, was very much what had been predicted. He was staying in Janina, the regional capital of West Darfur, and there are internally displaced persons camps around Janina, IDP camps, as they're called, where many refugees whose homes had been destroyed and villages had been destroyed were living in those camps, mostly women and children. And one of these camps had been attacked by the Janjaweed militia. So Sherif and his friend Ahmed had been involved in trying to help women and children escape. And he was actually targeted. I later learnt he was shot by a sniper. He and Ahmed then sought refuge in a what they thought was a safe house. But the Janjaweed then tracked them down and they were brutally beaten and killed. So that's what happened. His poor little daughter then became an orphan at the age of 2 months.
Waging Peace is amplifying what we're calling the Darfur 20 campaign, 20 years since the internationally recognized start of the genocide in Darfur. And the reason I actually presence this with two streams of reality is because from everything we know and all of the testimony that we have taken and understood and all of the work we have done within the community and with those seeking asylum here in the UK, is there has never been an end to this conflict. It is ongoing. And yet, somehow the international community has framed this as a conflict of the past and therefore has gone away. So we are here to shout about the fact that it has not, and that there are still people in insufferable conditions and fleeing for their lives. We need to do something about it. We need to continue to do something about it and raise the attention to the highest levels of policy makers in the UK to do something. And we have some policy recommendations on the immigration situation and also the crisis in Sudan.
I am far less qualified to talk about the conflict in Sudan and the what ifs there. But coming back to Britain and the UK and the hostile environment, this was a man who had enormous integrity, enormous intelligence, enormous will to do good in the world, and deserved also just to have a normal life like anybody, even if he hadn't had those wonderful characteristics. You know, I mean, it's sort of, in a way, it's wrong to talk about Sherif in these terms, because it sort of makes him special or cut out as different to others. This, what we're talking about, is human rights. You don't have to be an angel or amazingly charismatic person to have human rights. We all have human rights. I suppose because of my deep love of Sherif as a friend and knowing him as I did, it's particularly galling to know that he was such a good person. He had so much to offer. I mean, what ifs? You know, if he had been granted refugee status, on arrival, which he should have been. Everybody knew about the conflict, the genocide in Darfur. It was top of the news agenda in 2004.
One of the things is Sudan could be added to the list of countries whose nationals qualify for streamlined asylum processing, as there are many thousands of individuals still stuck in limbo whose cases are not progressing. And these are cases from 2, 3, 4 years ago. They are just stagnating and on hold. So there's a need to deal fairly and quickly with the backlog of these asylum cases in the UK. There's a need to expedite applications for family reunion made by Sudanese nationals. The languishing without the family being together when there has been a successful asylum claim also feels a little bit, dare I say, intentional. The lack of expediting causes even more harm and more stress on individuals and more danger, because those families back in Sudan, as we can see right now, are still in immediate danger. There's a need for expanding family reunion and that definition to include immediate adult relatives, as so many are being caught out by, you know, these really narrow definitions. We can expedite out-of-country applications under the immigration rules made by Sudanese nationals. We can make clear the welcome policy for those recently evacuated. There seems to be a massive difference that people are identifying in how different groups and families are welcomed and given integration advice. So not taking away from any community that deserves to receive asylum, but we can see it when we look at the policy surrounding evacuees from Ukraine, and there is a big difference, a massive difference.
Many Sudanese, many members of the Masalid community who came after him, they learn a lot from him and the others.
Yeah, I'm just really sitting with the question of resilience and what that means.
You know, I saw Sherif on numerous occasions where he had really awful setbacks and tragedies that he had to deal with. And of course, he was knocked back. And of course, his mental health was affected. But anyone who knew him, many, many people who knew him were really in awe of his capacity to carry on and to stick to his principles, stick to what was really important, and to do those things.
What I notice in terms of this resilience is the will to give back, to be of service. And there's something in that. I know many people starting with, many groups, many people starting with the Masalit community that Saif has already spoken about, to do the work that they're doing to support their community and wider community members in the UK and also back home. It's incredible. It's incredible.
And of course, you know, as with so many people, he had so much to offer, and that was squandered because he wasn't given the support he needed to integrate.
Sherif and other people have shown them that even if you are starting from scratch, it is possible in this country to make a very decent life. As long as you are ambitious, as long as you work hard, this country opens all the doors for you to grow up. Sherif is someone who wasn't very much lucky to go all the way to university. His education was very basic. Somebody with that level of education to make it all the way to here, to the UK, to make a life and then make a family and try to deliver to that family, I think this was something like a foundation for those people.
At the time that I met Sharif, I was going through a lot of changes in my life, which were difficult. I was in the process of getting divorced, but also I had a lot of health concerns, and I was in the process of being diagnosed with what I later discovered was multiple sclerosis. He was just always so generous with his support. But in my case, I really felt the warmth of his friendship. He was, I have many good friends and I've had a lot of support from a lot of people. But in the case of Sharif, I felt completely safe with him. And I knew that I could rely on him. And he was just there to help.
As long as you are in the West, you can reflect the atrocities, the difficulties that your community is suffering. The Masalit community learned that lesson, and the action followed that was to take every Masalit child to school. Education is the solution. It is the only way for the Masalit community to survive.
Sharif contributed very positively to Haringey Welcome. The contributions that he did make were very strategic and very useful to us, and very important. Early on, we were campaigning for our local authority to resettle Syrian families. This was back in 2015-16. And we had an event which was very well attended. It was a really good event. On this occasion, Sharif allowed us to share his story as part of a performance, a dramatic performance. I think, you know, it's refugees are often asked to share their story. And we've talked about this in another episode with Abdulrahman, how the toll this takes on people to have this constant expectation to tell your story. And it was incredibly generous of Sharif to be willing to share such personal and traumatic details with us. In 2019, in October 2019, Haringey Welcome was lucky enough to be given the opportunity to have a delegation to the European Parliament in Brussels to submit a petition. And the petition was related to the Brexit negotiations. And what we wanted to highlight was our concerns about the impact that Brexit would have on refugees and migrants in the UK, and what could be done about that. So we went together, Sharif and myself, we went to Brussels and stayed for, I think, two nights or three nights, and went to the European Parliament to talk about our concerns. We met a lot of MEPs. We spoke in the parliamentary chamber, and Sharif again came to share his experience of being a refugee in Britain and to talk about what he'd been through.
We are certainly dedicated to continue our support to the Masalit community here in the UK and the executive body. As long as they want us, we will be here.
It shows that people still, I mean, mothers, pregnant women, still lose their life because of this war. Again, children were left orphans, like Sharif's daughter. And this means that it is the responsibility of the whole world, including the Masalit community, to look after those ones. And this is a big generation.
Everybody knew about the conflict, the genocide in Darfur. It was top of the news agenda. Had he been granted refugee status and family reunion, had he been granted the support to attend ESOL lessons, to study, to build a life here, not only would that have avoided him having to live years of trauma and re-trauma and guilt and suffering, he would have been able to contribute from his wonderful capacities. And we've all lost out as a result of this punitive system that exists in this country, which just doesn't help anyone at all. We in Haringey Welcome, we go on about welcome, but this is a prime example. If you help people to integrate, if you welcome people into communities, into society, we all benefit. That's the bottom line. And conversely, if we don't do that, if we put up barriers, if we treat people in, the racism, the xenophobia, the othering, the hostility, when you introduce that into services, systems, policies, it poisons the well of society. On every episode of No Small Victories, we ask this question to our guests. If you had three wishes come true, what would your three wishes be? So I don't know who wants to go first. Perhaps Sonia?
One wish is for equality. I'm talking racial, gender, religious, equality. Everything that entails, because what we're seeing in Sudan has been a real imbalance of equality. And we see this in our daily lives here in the UK as well. So another wish is accountability. Somehow we as a society have forgotten that true accountability is basically a boundary. It's saying this policy, this behavior, this whatever is not okay. And through accountability mechanisms, we can heal. And my other wish, my last wish, and thank you for indulging me, is for humans to be more connected to their own hearts, their own heart space. And if we were individually taking that responsibility to really be able to touch into what makes us human, I think we'd see a massive change in what's reflected to each other and around the world.
I will start by number one. On the top of all is to end the war. My wish is to see this war over and people go back to live as normal citizens in the same country without any prejudice, without any discriminations and all these type of things. And of course, that entails the reform of political agenda. It also entails the reform of legislations. Number two is justice. There has been so much injustice in the past 20 years at individual level, at the group level. People lost their lives just due to the injustice. People, someone like Sharif lost his life for no good reason. I don't know what the reason is. And those who have killed him, those who have shot him dead, are still walking around the same area. People know them. People know the perpetrator. I really wanted to see justice. Maybe because we are talking about Sharif, my third wish is to Haringey organization and Waging Peace and all these ones to keep on playing this role, to keep on playing the role of being advocates for better life in this world. We need to advocate for the resources to be channeled to those people, not necessarily only to Sudan. I know injustice in many other parts of the world. I know many other parts of the world that need the resources
I am 100% sure we have enough resources.
Thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation. We've attempted to weave together many different strands here, both from moving from the life of our friend Sharif and his place here in Haringey and in the UK, the work that he undertook, back to Darfur and your childhood there, looking at the conflict in Darfur, the genocide, bringing us up to date to the current crisis. Thank you both so much for this incredibly rich and wonderful conversation. We're really grateful to you both. Thank you. As a bitter testament to how volatile the current crisis in Sudan is, the day after we recorded our interview with Sonia and Saif, a massive attack began in Jenaina, the capital of West Darfur, where many of Sharif's surviving relatives live. As of now, we have no definite news of their whereabouts. The UN estimated on the 21st of May that approximately 85,000 people had been secondarily displaced from IDP camps in Jenaina, and civilians have been left without healthcare, water, and basic supplies. Many survivors have been forced to flee over the border to Chad. Across Sudan, nearly 1.4 million people have been displaced since the conflict started on the 15th of April. We must call again urgently for safe routes, family reunion, and for the supportive welcome that the UK should be providing right now to refugees fleeing Sudan. On the 18th of June this year, 2023, we will be gathering at a commemorative bench for Sharif in Alexandra Park for a picnic and memorial event in support of Sudanese communities in the UK. This is the last episode of season one of No Small Victories. We hope you've enjoyed listening. We'll be back in the autumn with further tales of resistance from our community. If you found this talk inspiring, please like, subscribe, and share. If you have time, please write a review of our podcast as well so we can raise our profile and spread the word. You can find out more about the conflict and history of Sudan and about Sharif's life in the description to the show, as well as links to Haringey Welcome and how you can get involved. No Small Victories is presented by me, Lucy Nabijou. It's produced by Tanya Harmer and edited by Tom Newman. The series music is composed by Jamie Myers, who also produced its artwork. Music for this episode is kindly provided by Sudanese musicians Nuri and his Dorpa band, and Abu Obeida Hassan. Both artists are on Ostinato Records. There are links to their Bandcamp pages in the show notes. Full podcast interviews will be deposited at the Living Refugee Archive at the University of East London. Our thanks to archivist Paul Dudman for his collaboration in ensuring we can preserve a record of the amazing work being done in Haringey and beyond.